That's improv, bitch. Improv, bitch.
I mean, after all, you're nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
I'm Jimmy Corrine, and this is a very special episode of Improv Nerd. You know Dave Koechner from Anchorman and The Office. He was also my roommate back in Chicago in the 90s. We sat down with him at the Laugh Factory in Chicago, and we talked about the early days, living in a dwarf's house, what the cast of Anchorman really thought while they were filming it, and why Dave thought he wasn't asked back to Saturday Night Live.
We are here at the Laugh Factory in Chicago. We have a very special guest, a very special improv nerd. You know him from Anchorman and The Office, Dave Koechner.
Hello, Jimmy. Thanks for having me.
And just for full disclosure, we know each other for how long?
Since 87.
When you first came to Chicago, right?
I came in 86, but I didn't start taking classes till 87, and that's when we would have met.
Right. And originally you were from Tipton, Missouri.
Yeah.
And small town.
I grew up in a small town, Tipton, Missouri, 2,000 people. And then I went to the University of Missouri. No, I went to Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas. I was a poli-sci major. And then I went to the University of Missouri briefly. And then I quit doing that because I realized I didn't want to be a poli-sci major. And I came to Chicago to visit a friend and saw the Second City. And it was the first time I realized, like, oh, they teach. That's what they teach there. And so that's when I moved to Chicago.
And you came to study with Del Close?
No, I came because I was going to start taking classes at Second City. I'd come the year before and took classes at the Players Workshop for 2 weeks. And so I was going to come back and take classes at the Second City. And when I moved to town, I read an article in the Sunday Entertainment section about this cat named Del Close and Sharna Halpern and how they were going to start doing television. I thought, well, that's the place to go. And as it turned out, I was so fortunate to study with Del for 3 years and do that first. And I think simultaneously at some point, I started taking classes at the IO first and then started taking classes at Second City. So I was in both at the same time. And then Sharna took us out to Los Angeles.
Now, I never got to go because I didn't even make the cut. But tell us about how awful that was.
It was awful. We didn't know what was going on. We thought it was going to be a big break. And Sharna was talking it up. And I'd been in Chicago for 2 years. And I thought, wow, I can't believe it's going to happen this fast. We flew out to Los Angeles. And it was an improv game show hosted it was like a gong show, which was a variety show in the 70s or 80s where bad acts would come on and do something ridiculous and they'd either get gonged or get through the next level. And it was somewhat like that, but it was going to be celebrity judges with people doing short form improv.
Now, people have to know this is way before Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Way before Whose Line, and they had an improv barrel. And they'd pull suggestions out. We're supposed to do a scene. And the celebrity judges were Michael Douglas, Danny DeVito, and it may have been Rhea Perlman.
I'm not sure, but I think, didn't Michael Douglas' company produce it? Wasn't that the tie-in?
Yeah, and then they had some L.A. people out there improvising as well. And we were all out of our element because we were all doing long form. We didn't do games. Mm-hmm. And I guess Del had said, here's what's going to happen when you guys would go out there. First thing they're going to do is fire your best improvisers. And so myself, Noah Gregoropoulos, and Pete Gardner, I think, got fired or not let go. We're like, you're not going to be in the show. Went out there. Farley was out there, too, and there was like 9 or 10 of us. And then they did the show, and it didn't go. It was just a pilot. And then we came back home, and that was that.
How was that the first time you being fired?
Well, not fired, but it was not included in what was going to be the final product for the pilot. That hurt. It was weird. But interestingly enough, I didn't adjust to the medium, which was, looking back, it's kind of interesting that I wasn't aware enough to go, what was the target and what did you miss? I didn't think about it. Came back and just...
When you mean what is the target, what did you miss? What are you talking about?
Well, what was it that prevented me from being on that show, because what they wanted was short form jokes. And in my stage of my development, I was more interested in doing relationships in the scenes, which was my proclivity to do, which was great here doing long form, but it didn't work for what that was. But I remember I never even gave it a second thought of, like, why didn't my strengths translate to television? I didn't analyze it at all. And looking back, you know, if you'd had someone side coaching you, it would have been, hey, so how was it? What worked? What didn't work? How can you improve it? I just came back to Chicago and played around some more.
But people also have to understand, when we were doing it back then, that there was this artistic mentality. It was like, yes, we were an artistic colony.
Because we'd studied with Dell, mm-hmm. it was more about, because Dell would say, treat your audience like poets and artists, and then you have they have a chance to become them. So we thought we were poets and artists, and, you know, damn the torpedoes, and who cares what media wants. We're going to do what we want.
There's also a great story about, I don't know what, Dell didn't know people's names and stuff like that. Do you remember this? Dell had signed something to say that he knew your name.
Well, I had mentioned, Dell was not the best conversationalist.
And what would you think, for people who don't know his personality, what would you say it was? Describe it.
And I don't blame him, looking back. He was disinterested. Not interested. Disinterested means something else. He was not interested in having a relationship with the students. And I don't blame him. When students, you'd come up after class or you'd see him after a show and go up and try and spark a conversation. Dell was interested. If you had weed to get him high, and I don't blame the guy, of course, fuck yes. He'd sit around, let's hang out. But if you were going to be some fucking student who wants to come up and talk, he was not interested. And now, being nearly 50 myself, I wouldn't be interested. Yeah, I teach you. We're not going to be buddies. We're not going to hang out. Unless you got some fucking weed, then you can get me high, and then you probably have something we can talk about. I don't blame the guy. I remember once when we were at the tracks, and I went out to try and talk to Dell.
Which is this bar.
Bar where we were performing, and it was just a conversation went nowhere, because I had nothing to say, and I was nervous and all that. And I don't blame the dude. Like, I, you know, now you go, walk away from me, please, walk away. And so I'd mentioned it to Sharna
Halperin, who is the producer of the Improv Olympics,
Dell's handler. I'd said, I don't think Dell knows who I am, and I was pretty good at what I do, and so I was.
And you had been in classes for a while.
Yes, and I was on the house team, and I was a good improviser, you know. And not to say, I was one of the better ones.
Dave, you were very good.
Right.
Okay.
So, I was always.
I don't know why you're so modest about that.
Well, yeah. So, I was as good as anybody else. And I said to Sharna, I don't think Dell knows who I am. So, Dell, it was very nice. Sharna did for me 1 year for my birthday. She had typed up something that said, my name is Dell Close, and I know who David Koechner is. And then Dell wrote on the bottom of that, Merry Christmas to what's-his-name-o. Which, and I think he scratched it out and wrote Happy Birthday. But I think the mistake of Merry Christmas was honest. And this was in August.
Also around that time, when we met each other at the I.O. doing Tequila Mockingbird, it was kind of an exciting time because you had Chris Farley there, who was like mm-hmm. a rocket ship in terms mm-hmm. of, and Mike Myers would sit on our team.
Would come and play with us.
What was that like for you?
You know, it was interesting in that we were so immersed in the thing that we were doing. At the time, there was not a lot of, there were not a lot of schools. There was basically the I.O., or the Improv Olympic, there was Second City, and I think there was...
Well, the Players' Workshop.
But that's not something we do. There was another Improv Institute.
Right.
But it quickly became kind of understood that the place to really learn improvisation was the I.O. Then they're going to hire you one day at Second City, and you'll make money. But if you really want to be good, you go to the I.O. And so my memory of it, looking back, was we're all, is more like this collective, where we were, it's more like socialism meets improvisation. It was the most important thing to us. We talked about it all the time. We were very passionate about it, and we were doing it all the time. And the reason I mentioned there were fewer places to study, also because this is before the improv explosion, which I'm not sure what year it happened, but there weren't multiple levels everywhere. There was only levels 1 through 5 at Second City, and there were only 3 levels at the Improv Olympic. And so after level 1, you got put on a team and you were on stage. So we would be on stage. So after 6 weeks or 8 weeks, whatever it was, we were put on a team, we were on stage, and we were still taking classes once or twice a week, and we were doing shows once or twice a week. And then you were doing classes somewhere else too. So you would be in class 3 or 4 times a week, and you'd be on stage 3 or 4 times a week. So that was an amazing advantage that we had, which probably doesn't exist now. And that was the difference. And you look back at it, and, you know, we knew that Myers was special. He'd mm-hmm. been at Second City in Canada, and we could tell that Farley was different than everybody else. Because mm-hmm. what, you know, anyone would do is you compare yourself to your compatriots, and you go, how am I in relation to the people I respect? Well, we're all kind of moving together. And then Farley comes along, and he's so amazing because of his unique specialness. Let's just call it that. It wasn't about workmanship. When you think about talent, that's Chris Farley. It was just God-given ability to make everyone convulse in laughter. And he loved it. He relished it. It was beautiful. And his level of commitment is unparalleled. It's nothing. I've never seen anything like it since. He was just this genuine, beautiful vessel of comedy. So when Chris came along, and when I'm talking about comparativeness with ourselves, go, okay, we're all moving together, and Farley comes along, and he's just clearly outer space special. I remember thinking, well, I'm not going to put Chris Farley in my league because I'm not in his. Uh-huh. He's out of the mean. Mm-hmm. Okay, Chris doesn't exist, but I'm still in keeping up with my buddies, right? And so then we're all waiting around to get hired by Second City. And why doesn't it happen now? And what's going to be next? And because that was all of our goal. And we just kept doing it, right? And some of us branched out. We were in groups together. But then there becomes a point where it's time to leave the Improv Olympic. And things were changing there. We went from venue to venue to venue.
Right.
And then sometimes you don't feel appreciated and you move on.
And then we did do that, and you actually did a show called Jazz Freddy. We did that together.
Well, the first thing we did when we broke off from the I.O. was we went and did a show called The Comedy Underground.
Which had, like, Andy Richter in it, Jay Leggett.
Brian McCann, Brian Stack,
who
Kevin
for Conan.
You, me, Noah. Madeline?
No, we didn't have any.
Not one woman.
We didn't have any women.
There were 10 really good improvisers, and Sharna had lost her place, and so we took one over, and it was a bit of a schism. And then that, you know, then we find out ourselves how club owners will fuck you over.
Right. And you remember the night that we took a vote, Jon Favreau wanted to play?
I don't remember that.
There was a night, yeah, that Jon Favreau wanted to play, and I think it was a couple weeks into the run, and there was a casting agent, and we did not allow him to play.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I do not remember that. Oh, so he wanted to come up with us because the casting agent wanted to see him?
Yes.
Wow. Well, I understand it. I would now, being who I am, I would say, you know, that's going to be good for everybody. Mm-hmm. The casting agent's there. Let's let John play.
But I think that was, back then, that was that artist mentality that we had.
Yeah. But that was part of that. And also, there was some arrogance, which is never...
On your part?
All of ours.
Yeah.
If we didn't let him do it.
Right. Well, that's what I remember.
It doesn't serve you.
Remember when people would get in the Second City, we'd say, oh, they don't deserve to get in the Second City?
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, folks, the judgment, there's no place for judgment in your life. Or judging anyone else's. It just, it doesn't serve you. That's ego. And the
Is
ego,
it?
Ego kills.
is judgment gone in your life? Because I got to tell you something. Some of the funniest things that I, and seeing your show tonight at the Laugh Factory in Chicago, some of the funniest things would when you would come home from a rehearsal and you have a problem with either an actor or a director, and you channeled all your anger into an imitation about them.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, if you used, and again, tonight, of course, you have those things. And, you know, as you get older, you try to become more zen-like, and you meditate, and you're trying to find your center. So that's the goal. But, yeah, I guess judgment can serve you. And then there's that question of, is it judgment, or can you also have fun with the observation of it? I'd say the thing that would stymie me was wrapping all of the energy into that feeling I'd have about the person. That's one thing. So you can have an observation about a person and channel it into something funny, and it didn't have to be so couched in the bitterness.
But I think, and this is just, I guess this is my judgment of you early on, there was almost like a conspiracy, like people were out to get you. Is that a fair thing? Or people were in your way, or...
Right, and no one's in your way. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, and that's, you know, you're younger. I'm from a small town, so I think I probably felt inferior. I'm living in the big city. I knew I was not as sophisticated as people around me.
Because when you came to Chicago, you would say, you know, "Oh, I'm a hayseed." Remember this? You would joke about this.
Oh well, and people let me know that too. Sometimes my choices of clothing were ridiculed, and I really, honestly, didn't know why. And I was the butt of jokes, and you feel terrible. And you're like, what? Am I really that rubbish? Am I that raw? So then, yeah, you own it.
Now, you came from Tipton, mm-hmm. in a very conservative Catholic family, mm-hmm. six kids.
Yeah.
At 10 and 13, you realize that you want to get out of the small town.
When I was 10, I still have this memory, very distinct, walking around the west side of my house, feeling a bit melancholy, but knowing I have to get out of the small town. I have to live in a city, and I knew that. And I have a distinct memory of being in eighth grade, which I'm 12 or 13, and standing by my treehouse and thinking, I want to go do something important. I want to go do something special. So that's why I thought I should get into politics.
And what did you think you were going to be in terms of?
I thought I was going to be a senator.
Really?
Yeah, or a president.
And it's funny because when we first met, certainly there was the insecurity that you were a rube from Tipton, Missouri. But there was also a worldly quality that you had that I didn't have. And I grew up in the
Is that right?
Yeah. What was the college experience like in terms of giving you, because you weren't small town mentality when you came here. I didn't experience
that. That's good. Well, I had the desire to know more. I had healthy intellectual curiosity. Mm-hmm. I wanted to learn. Mm-hmm. I wanted to learn wherever I was. And when we were taking classes, that was graduate school and doctoral thesis all wrapped into one every day, every night. And we challenged each other, and we challenged ourselves, and it was always about get better, get better, get better. There was a real passion with everyone. And mm-hmm. I don't know if it exists now, because now in the media and everything else, the thing that's been important is to be famous. There was no one that spoke about being famous. There was a passion about being better and better and be the best and be the best and be the best, which I don't know if that attitude still exists. You would know better because you're a teacher.
I can just say, going back to those times, if you had a commercial agent and you were going on commercials, we thought you were selling out.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And I don't know, today it's more business, but I think back then we were so focused on the art.
We were. Yes, I agree. It was a bit myopic. We weren't thinking about the business at all, and I never did. I never did until I left town, and even then I really didn't focus on it.
You mean when you got to Saturday Night Live?
And my buddy Eric Zickman said, find the
target.
Who's
a writer for...
Yes, for many, multiple things.
Frasier is one of them.
Yep. Darman, Greg, Frasier, now hot in Cleveland. He and I developed a sitcom at one point. Eric is a lovely, amazing man, one of my favorite people on the earth. And I'd met him at New York a couple years before that. And so when I did the real life Brady Bunch, and he had said to me, he gave me a piece of advice, which I didn't understand. He said, find the target. You have the opportunity to influence pop culture, because he's a very bright guy. He said, find the target. And I didn't know what that meant. And I dismissed it. But it was one of the best pieces of advice ever given to me.
How does it apply to your life now?
My life now is dual. My real, honest passion and focus is my family. That's probably more important to me than my career. And I understand that I have probably compromised certain portions of my career to focus on the family, but that will serve me, and it serves me every day. And I know that's what's important. But I understand it because find the target means, you know, what works in show business right now, what works every day. And I still go back to what we started, what we came up with. Like, you know what? What's important? If you are just an artist, that's enough. That will always serve you. You can do your art and people will come to it. So do your art. And it'll be something that has value.
So you leave Chicago. You get Saturday Night Live in 1995.
Yep. Jimmy and I, by the way, were roommates.
We were roommates. And which
that was a couple years.
A couple years, yeah. We lived in the Dwarfs apartment, remember
Jimmy
that?
Jimmy and I were very close friends.
Yeah.
Did I say were?
Yeah.
Still are.
And we lived in this is true, we lived in an apartment that
Jimmy
Corain used to live there.
Jimmy Corain was the best man at my wedding.
Yes.
We lived in a house in Roscoe Village before it became what it is now. And apparently, it was a three flat, and the top floor was occupied by the owner of the house, who had built the bottom two floors out, remodeled them, and the top floor he fashioned. And Jimmy and I both noticed, like, there was something really weird about the apartment we were living on, the top floor apartment. The handles on the doors were low, the light switches were low, the sink was so... the cabinets were so low, we had to sit in a chair to do the dishes. And we asked the landlord one day, well, like, what's the deal with this apartment we're living in? And she said, oh, that was a dwarf's house. Mm-hmm. A dwarf had owned the apartment down the street on Roscoe, where Roscoe meets Ashland, where now sits a Jewel Osco, was an amusement park
Riverview.
Called Riverview. Years before, after World War II, was very popular. There was a musical that played at the Goodman at one point called Riverview. And all up and down Roscoe Avenue, the denizens, the workers of Riverview, which was a year-round amusement park, lived. And this guy, this dwarf, was a guy that plied his trade, his dwarf talents, at Riverview. We don't know what he did, but he was smart because then he bought property, fashioned the top apartment for himself, and rented out the other two. Up and down Roscoe, there were all storefronts, and apparently, from what we were told, they were all bars. It was a rough area.
And we were just glad because we were another show people taking over that apartment.
Show people living in show people's places.
1995, Saturday Night Live. What is the most surreal moment from that show?
Well, I'll tell you the truth, Jimmy. I always knew I was going to get the show.
How? Can you explain that?
I can't. When I was a fan of the show from the very beginning, I was 13 when it debuted on NBC in 1976.
And you're talking about the original cast.
The original cast.
Chevy Chase and Belushi,
Aykroyd, Radner, Curtin.
Garrett Morris.
Garrett Morris.
Lorraine Newman.
Newman.
And then later Bill Murray.
Yep. After Chevy left, after the first year. And so I was a fan of it, and I dreamed, like, I'm going to be on that show one day. I'm going to be on that show one day. So when I got to Chicago, I knew two things. I'm going to be on stage at Second City, and I'm going to be on Saturday Night Live. I knew that. I just made that decision, and then it came true. And I've said, too, that when I was at Second City, when I was at Saturday Night Live, I had a feeling like, wow, this show has kind of gotten off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I want to stay there very long. I thought, I'm going to be here 3 years and I'm going to take off. That was my plan. And as they say in the world of The Secret or divination, sometimes the universe will hear you early, because I thought, like, I'm going to be here a later year, and I take off.
Because you had a great year.
I had a great year. And then the powers that be decided, yeah, why don't you go ahead and go? Because I wouldn't, they'd ask me to do like a Gerald Tibbins talk show, and I would say, that's what's wrong with this show. We have too many TV parodies and talk shows. We need to do more original material. And they go, okay. They weren't asking me. They were telling me, do that character as a talk show, and it would have worked. And I'd also insulted the head writer at one point and didn't know it. And so it was the first year that there was any late night competition, the year I was on the show. And I had a great year. We had the first hit characters in the show with the Fops, and I was told that Del really liked them, which meant a lot to me. And so I had a great year, and I was surprised to hear that my contract was under consideration to not be renewed. And so I wasn't picked back up, and that hurt like a motherfucker. I couldn't believe it. But, you know, that's the way it should go. And I'd already decided I wasn't going to stay more than 3 years. But things, when you decide things, they happen. And it happened faster. So it's the power of decision.
You know, you talk about your personality and insulting people and stuff like that. Knowing you early in your career, there was a sense of, I guess, a little superiority, would you say?
Yeah.
I remember doing that. We did it was a Seinfeld takeoff. Do you remember this?
Yes.
It was a trade show.
Yes, a trade show.
And you, I mean, a trade show is like, whatever they give you, go and do it. And we had to stay up the night before to rewrite it because you thought it was crap.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, it didn't work. Remember?
Right. Yeah.
What was written at one point didn't work when it got to the trade show.
Uh-huh.
And this woman started yelling at me like it was my problem.
And you were playing Brainer, which was the Kramer character, and I was playing George Costanza.
Whoever this woman that was in charge of it had seen someone else do it a different way, and she thought, well, that should work.
Mm-hmm.
Do it the way that guy did it. And the real problem, the issue was, the script didn't work. It wasn't the performance, which really bothered me, that this woman that knew nothing about this kept blaming the performance. And it was like, the script doesn't work. It's not the actors.
So getting back to Saturday Night Live, do you think that had you not been as superior and judgmental at that time, that you would have still been on that show?
Yeah, probably. But again, my failing was not having the correct focus. And my focus at that time was, this isn't. Oh, here's what, you know what Lorne Michaels said to me? Because what had happened was, like I was saying earlier, there was the first night that there was first year there was competition late night. It was the first year of Mad TV, and then Howard Stern had a late night television show, so the ratings went down. So the people in NBC, the people in the industry that worked at NBC on the West Coast for the first time in the run of the show had power over Lorne Michaels. Before then, he had an autonomous situation out there. No one ever told him what to do. It was the first time they ever told him what to do. And there was one guy named Don Olmeyer who apparently didn't like the Fops because he thought they were gay. And this guy was apparently a homophobe. And he said, get rid of that guy. And Lorne couldn't protect his pawns. He couldn't tell him to fuck off. And he wanted to. Lorne wanted to keep me on the show. There's no question. But he couldn't. He had to yield. He had to bend. And my final meeting with Lorne, he said, David, you're an artist. Don't change that. Which I took as a great compliment. Because he understood it.
Mm-hmm.
That was very, very sweet and very caring.
And so then you go to L.A.
Go to L.A. I got a holding deal right away.
Uh-huh.
And then within 6 months, I met the woman that I married. So that's the way, here's the weird thing, that's the way it was supposed to go.
But at the time, you don't see that.
You don't know that. And the other thing that I know now is, whatever happens, every moment, embrace it. Don't fight it.
2004, you do this movie called Anchorman.
Yeah.
How do you get the part?
Adam McKay had written, and Adam and Will had written another movie called...
Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, who was...
So what did I say? Did I say Will and Adam?
You just said Will.
Will and Adam had written a movie called August Blowout, which was a hilarious comedy about car salesmen. And it was funny, and it didn't get made. And then, so they wrote another movie called Anchorman. And it was a hilarious movie about Anchorman. And Will had not become the big star that he is now, so he couldn't automatically green light this movie. They wouldn't just green light it on Will's thing. And so that laid around for a year or so, and then Will did...
Oh, it was Old School. Thanks,
thank you.
Ben, our producer.
Old School. He pushed through on Old School. It was like, boom, this is Will Ferrell's movie. So then he got some heat, so then it was like, what's the next Will Ferrell movie? And the people, the producers that read Anchorman had no fire. They could not get their heads around it. Finally got it greenlit. I auditioned for the movie. Everyone in town auditioned for it. I think I had the advantage because I know Will and I know Adam and I understood the tone that they were trying to hit. Mm. And I think that helped me get the job. And they couldn't say, we want Koechner, because they didn't have the power at the time. And they purposely didn't say Koechner should be the guy because they understood the game of, if we say we want this guy, they will say absolutely not that guy. It's like a power issue. It's a weird thing. So they just showed three guys for my part to the producer, the head producer. And the head producer said, why not that guy? Which was me. And they were secretly going, fuck yes. And so they called me once they knew, which they even admitted was beyond protocol because it has to go through the right channels. But they were so excited. And I remember that night they called me and said, you got the part, blah, 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 blah. And so that was how it went down.
And, you know, as watching your stand-up act here tonight, there's a part where you recite lines from the movie.
Right.
How much of those were improvised?
Oh, from the movie?
From the movie.
Well, I can't really remember. I know that Adam is so magnanimous when it comes to doing the movie, all of his movies. What we would do is, the script was amazingly funny, gloriously funny. And I remember thinking, I don't think I can improvise anything better than what's already written, because Adam and Will are brilliant. Really.
Were you intimidated a little, I mean, with the cast and stuff?
Not with the cast at the time, because they weren't stars.
Uh-huh.
Steve Carell wasn't a star. Mm-hmm. Paul Rudd wasn't a star. Will was kind of a star, but I'd known Will for
right.
a long time. I was intimidated because the script was so good. It's like, I can't beat these lines. These are great. So what you see on film is either had it already been scripted, or there might be a few words that are changed, or it might be a hybrid of a line of something that they came up with and then you came up with something else. All I know is that Adam inviting us to improvise in the process before, in rehearsal and in the process, was so welcoming to improvise that it infected the way the movie was made and the chemistry and the tone. And that's what made it great, was because he was open to the process.
Why do you think the movie is so iconic?
Well, it's a very long answer.
Okay.
I think the movie is so iconic because in its heart and soul, it is a satire of the United States, the white American male. And it hits it on the fucking mark. It is about a woman having power within a male-dominated society. And if you look at America's evolution, when you think about the impossibility that there was a society that existed that didn't allow women to vote, it's so fucking ridiculous. So that it was a milestone achievement that a woman would dare be an anchor? I mean, that's a satire. We're making fun of white, dumbass white guys who are trying to cling to power and being, you know, exclusive. So that's what the real thing is. That's what it is. It's satire. And it hits it on the money. And because it is so tender with its skewering of these guys, because they're making them all out to be buffoons, and they're lovable buffoons. And so any white guy can watch it and go, oh, that's okay. It's kid gloves. But everyone else goes, oh, Jesus, yes. Remember that? That's ridiculous that anyone would ever act that way, but they really did. And it's a heightened reality. But at its core, that's really what it is. It's a satire of the ignorance of the white American male. Now, everyone else is going to watch and go, no, it's just a big, dumb, stupid comedy. It's not. It was a really smart smart movie. And that's why it works. It hits people on an emotional level. It hits them on an intellectual level that they're not even know they're digesting, I think.
Did you know
they
when,
don't even
when
know
you were filming it, did you know this is the thing that people are going to remember me for?
We didn't know that. We knew that when we were making it, all of us had, after 1 week, we had all gone home to our spouses and said, holy shit, I'm not keeping up. And that's interesting, because all of us felt the other guy was...
When you say not keeping up, what do you mean?
Well, we all felt that everyone else in the movie was better than us. So I thought that Paul and Steve and Will were better than me, and Steve thought that myself and Paul and Will were better than him, and Paul thought that Steve and myself and Will were better than him. And
how did you find this out?
Myself, Paul, and Steve were in our trailers, and we were all gathered in one of them at once, and it slowly came up. We're like, oh, God, you guys are so good. And I was having a conversation with my wife, and every one of us had had that conversation with our wife. And then about halfway through the movie, because we all shot every day, we were all really feeling like, this seems special. This is uncommon. What's happening? Because I had done a bunch of film, mm-hmm. and so had Will, and so had Steve, and so had Paul. We'd all done a lot of productions, but we were all feeling like, this seems special. This is uncommon. And I say this a lot, that we all, I say it's like watching a no-hitter. You almost don't want to jinx it. You don't want to talk about it too much. We all felt like this could be a real, you know, special comedy that people are going to go, oh, that's a real good comedy. I had no idea it would become what it is. And I really, to be honest with you, Jimmy, I don't know what it is because I'm in it. I've seen the movie 2 or 3 times. People have seen this movie 50 times. This is an important movie to people. This is a special movie to people. They have ownership of this movie. I had no idea, and I still don't understand.
Because I know you, you probably say, I could have done better. Are you happy with your performance?
Oh, I'm very happy with my performance. There is a scene that that kills that didn't make the movie.
Okay.
That you can see online, where Champ professes his love to Ron Burgundy in a supremely uncomfortable way.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes think that had that scene been in the movie, it may have changed the trajectory of my career. But so what? Who cares? Everything happens for a reason. I'm very happy. I've got a wife and 5 kids. I adore her and all of them. I have always worked. I always will. I have that, and And I'm going to do the next Anchorman, which is awesome.
How do you feel about the next Anchorman? I don't, about, in terms of the pressure, that, you know, how are we going to rise the bar on this?
Oh, I'll be completely honest with you, Jimmy. I've never had one thought about pressure. Completely honest with you.
Okay.
My assumption is this thing is going to be fucking awesome. I've never had one instant of doubt. Adam and Will are so good that I know it's going to be great. And I know how talented everyone involved is, that doesn't even enter my mind that it could possibly falter.
Okay.
But to be completely honest.
Okay. And there's no fear of like, oh, it's going to be hard to get Champ back or anything like that. It's
no.
Okay. Okay.
No.
Let's talk about Todd Packer on The Office.
All right.
Okay. Guy's loud. He's obnoxious. He's a homophobe. He's alcoholic. You seem to get these kind of characters. They're in your wheelhouse.
Right.
What do you love about playing these characters?
They are out of bounds. You can play them larger. I don't mind hitting the back rafters. You can splash around in the warm tub and spill the water over the top and over the sides.
How much, when I see your characters, there's a sense of, there's a conflict in your characters. Certainly in Anchorman, I think certainly with Todd.
Oh, an internal conflict.
Yes.
Yes.
Where does that come from?
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Champ Kind is a latent homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
I find that to be hysterical.
Was that your choice or was that on
paper? No, it's in the script.
Okay.
It's in the script. And I built on that as it went because I think that irony is beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's so complex. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Same with Todd Packer. He's not a latent homosexual, but he's so immature and he's so struggling with his own identity. He has no idea who he is, which I think is a touchstone for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. We all, at some point, feel like, I don't know who I am. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I think you do in your characters that are, besides this great pathos, is you also, there's this low-status guy who thinks he's high-status.
Yeah, which is hilarious to me.
Now, does that come, where does that come from? Do you think that comes from Tipton at all?
Possibly.
Because
I mean, I can't be too self-analytical. You might be a better judge of that kind of thing. I don't think I even do it. It's probably something that comes very naturally to me. It might be people I know from my hometown who I knew, like, Jesus, who do you think you are? You're the dumbest guy in town. You think you're smart. There's real irony there.
You're doing stand-up now.
Yeah.
I watched it tonight. Dave, I'm going to say this, I'm sincere on this. It's you, pure you, everything that you do so well. And the stand-up part, the stories are wonderful, and the characters and stuff like that. How does it compare to doing improv for you? Do you feel...
How does it compare?
Let me ask you this.
Are you saying as a performance?
In terms of expressing who Dave Koechner is, improv versus stand-up.
Well, I don't think of it in terms of one versus the other. Mm-hmm. They're different animals. This is a solo performance. I can improvise in this solo atmosphere. I would say improvisation got me there. Because I can stand on stage without fear and know it's going to be okay. I don't even give it a second thought. A large part of what I do in my act has been improvised at one point or another. There's always some improvisation in my show. You might not even know it. I know what I do, so I'm always trying to build and get it better. Because the nature of improvisation, it always changes. It's allowed my act to evolve. I have no doubt or fear that I have. There's more. There's plenty more I can do. I don't struggle to generate material.
What are the tools from improv that you brought into your stand-up?
Just that thing. I don't have to struggle to generate material. My improv skills immediately inform and feed generation of material.
What do you want to be doing in the next 5 years?
I want to start making here's my dream, that I can make some small movies that have a healthy enough budget where I can work with all of my friends and get what I will call our voice imprinted on film and do that for the rest of my life. I would much rather be part of a collective film group of a certain point of view that I share with my compatriot friends from this community.
Chicago, and now into L.A.
And some L.A. And we can do our films and all make our money and just do what we do and find that audience that goes, I fucking love that. That's my favorite fucking thing. What they are doing is my favorite fucking thing. And I know once we do it, everyone will run to it and go, how can I be a part of it? And we'll go, just shut your mouth and get in.
Dave, we got to get going. Thank you so much for your time.
All right. We're shaking hands now.
Yeah.
I want to thank Dave Koechner. We taped this late on a Sunday night after his show at the Laugh Factory, and he was super generous with his time. Of course, I want to thank my producer, Ben Caprero, The Laugh Factory Chicago, and please, 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 please like us, Improv Nerd on Facebook. It really helps with my self-esteem. For more information about me or the Artist Low Comedy classes and workshops, any nominated improv classes and workshops, go to jimmycorain.com. Until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Not just Emmy nominated, you won the damn thing.
Oh, I did?
Yeah.
Oh, any not? Okay, okay.
Improv.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
It might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you fuck.